It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Good morning, Hezzy.
Good morning.
You know,
we piped in together.
Well, you know what I don't understand is, so how have you been able to keep your relationship where you still love one another, even though you have different ways of driving? How do you do that?
We don't drive together that much.
No. It's,
oh, okay.
When we're not driving together, it's real easy because we really do love one another. It gets a little challenged when we do drive together, however. And we're not going to really go into that. Right, Johnny?
I wasn't looking in for any insight that way.
Let me tell you about what happened when we were in Pennsylvania and I took a wrong turn and Johnny, emphatically said, pull over, and I did, and he said, get out of the car, and I did, and then he got behind the wheel. And so these kinds of things don't happen frequently. It's only happened how many dozens of times in the past. But the fact of the matter is, in answer to your question, other than that, we're totally in love with one another. And
we are totally in love with one another even during that. Anyway, I want to say that we watch a show called Virgin River. I think that's the name of it.
Yeah.
And the guy said to the girl in Virgin River, she was going to go kayaking with him or something, and it's really dangerous things. And he said, no, I don't want you to go because I would not put you in a situation where you could get hurt. Letting Laurie drive puts her in a situation, and me too usually, in a situation where she could get hurt. So I take the responsibility for getting her places safely. That's the truth.
I can't believe what you just said.
Believe it? It's on the radio.
Oh, my gosh. You never even said anything when that scene came up last
time. I know. I wanted to, but I didn't bring it up. I just thought.
Well, moving on.
Well, it's amazing you
and we are in love. Well, we were in love up until a few seconds ago.
Hey.
John and I are very lucky. I mean, it's not to say that we're lucky. Look at any relationship, whether it's a marriage or a friendship or anything of that nature, or, you know, within families, children and parents, etc., requires work. And they, you know, you often hear, or not often, but it is said that the toughest job in the world is being, you know, married. And it is, because it's two different people who meld into one and, you know, get through life together if they're lucky. And Johnny and I are very lucky, and that's how we approach our lives together. I truly, you know, the distaff side is how they refer to a wife in a marriage, but one half of the marriage, or what are they, the better half of the marriage is often what a wife is referred to, but it's not better. Neither one is better than the other. But the fact of the matter is, you know, again, another, you know, line, it takes two to tango, but it takes two people to pull together in the same yoke in a marriage, and that requires three big things. One is trust that can never be broken. Two is common interests and desires, you know, a common vision. And then three is, you know, the assurance of love. So fortunately, I found my helpmate in Johnny, and every day gets better and better, except when he's driving.
This is now a philosophical show. It's incredible how my wife manipulates these things.
Who brought up about the Virgin River thing?
Well, I was going to say, too, along those lines, since today's show is a little more about cars and life, but when you talk about marriage and those kinds of things, I have to agree with you. And I have a whole program in my business called Simpler Times. There's a number of events that are based around the concept of when times were simpler. And, of course, mine are all outdoor recreation types of things. But this idea of people pulling together, you know, in the 1800s, even early 1900s, families, you had lots of children because children were important to help work the farm, do the business. I mean, more important than getting them an education, it was important that the family pulled together. I mean, that's one of the great, I think, one of the great parts of A Christmas Carol. If you remember that Bob Cratchit had a pretty good family, and he said, "I found a guy who'll give you a job, you know, and he'll pay you this much money." And the kid's like 12 years old, and he's incredibly happy to be able to contribute to the family, you know. And as we've gotten, we've sort of gotten away from those things in the last, gosh, what? I don't know, at least the last
50, 70 years.
50, 70 years. I mean, after World War II. People mm-hmm. came back, economy was good, things just became different. Everybody was striving after things that, you know, would make you happy.
Well, not only that, but, you know, gathering together at supper was mandatory for us growing up.
Oh, yeah.
We always sat down to supper as a family. How many families can say that today?
This
could be a much longer conversation, but rather than that, we're going to talk about something today.
We're
going to
tie that into
microchips.
really, you are? That's
yes,
a
we
very
really
important
are.
Issue.
Well, we did not have a car to test this.
A new car to test. We still have the CX-5, which we loved,
and
we didn't want to do three shows on it.
Yeah, we did two wonderful shows on it, but this is the thing that really caught our attention. There is the microchip shortage, and there is a massive shortage on microchips. We're going to discuss why. Has had a huge impact on new and used car sales.
Well, back up. Mm-hmm. What we have found out, and I've heard this from people who I have sent places on wing shooting trips, my gosh, we can't get a rental car. And I thought, that's really odd. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, why can't you get a rental car? And then we learned in going to places, because you had said to us, well, when you can't get a car, maybe you could go to one of the local dealers. Local dealers don't have new cars. It's very difficult, and I'm like, well, I don't understand what's going on. And Lori then found this information. Now go, babe.
That we want to share with you because it's really incredible. And I know that, as Johnny said, people are talking about it, but we're going to talk about it. So there's a global microchip shortage. Now, a microchip are the tiny computer chips that power everything from an infotainment system to special safety features in a car and much, much more. However, as a result of the pandemic, microchip production has been almost, I mean, it boomed.
Well, tell them why.
Well, okay, so.
Microchips, you think, well, they can make a bazillion microchips.
But they can't. So what happened was when the pandemic first hit, automotive manufacturers, many of them, ceased manufacturing for a while. They literally, you know, shut down either parts or all of their production facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, it was concurrent with the need and the rise in demand for microchips for cell phones.
Let me say cell phones. Here's an interesting fact I learned. There are more cell phones than there are people in the world. If there are 7 billion
really?
Or 6 billion, yes, if there are 6, let's say 6 billion, I think it's 7 billion, but if there are 7 billion people in the world, there are 8 billion cell phones. People have multiple cell phones. It's unbelievable. One
you keep on the side so your loved one doesn't know? I mean, what's going on here? How many phones do you need?
Yeah, look, Lori has one, I have one, we have one for the house, plus we have a landline. We have three cell phones between the two of us. You know, kids have cell phones. I mean, I remember when there, you remember the kids in school, there was a big deal about, oh, you can't bring your cell phone to school. That's all gone away. You know, kids have cell phones. It's unbelievable how many people have. And you do have one for work, and you have one for personal.
So cell phones.
I did read yesterday that Hyundai was really very concerned about getting the electronics. You know, because it's not coming in. But that's
let's carry on.
The world.
And this is exactly why, because there was such an explosive demand by microchip manufacturers for personal electronics, phones, cell phones, laptops.
Why? Because people couldn't go anywhere.
Because people were now staying home, and they were working from home
and
during
talking
the pandemic.
On the phone.
Meanwhile, the auto industry shutters for a spell, and these orders come into the, you know, finite number of microchip chip manufacturers, and they're off filling orders for personal electronics. So when auto production began to resume, there weren't enough chips. So this has been a massive impact. And what's happened is this has significantly impacted new and used car inventory for dealerships. In fact, they're now saying they have no idea how long the shortage in microchips will last. They're saying that industry analysts say that it's going to go into 2022.
What's interesting is I know a good friend of mine, he's got a daughter. I don't know how many in the family, but certainly one daughter I'm aware of and two of his sons. And she decided she wanted to buy a Mercedes. It's on order now. And she hasn't gotten it for over 2 months. And she may have to wait another month or two.
She may have to wait a year. Because what's happened is the microchip manufacturing, the semiconductor industry, now has to adjust to this massive change in the market. So here's what's happened. There aren't enough chips. It's going to be well into 2022. When there will be sufficient chips, how does this affect car sales? Well, it's substantially driven up used car sales. And people are holding on to their existing vehicle longer, even though if they sold it, they could get more money than ever before. But it's just as your friend is. You can't get new cars. The new car purchases have declined as a result of not being able to get them and also because people are no longer trading in their existing car for a new one. When Johnny spoke about rental cars, car dealers who would usually, you know, have 300 to 400 vehicles available on the websites of rental car companies that then turn over their cars after a certain mileage and sell them, now there are none. So they could normally they could go online, they could pick a website for a rental car company, an Avis or Hertz National, who were then selling, you know, rotating out their stock. 300 or 400 cars. They can, no longer. There's not even one. So this has resulted in this being a seller's market. And used cars and trucks in May alone rose. Used cars and trucks in May alone rose 30%. And so that's great news if you want to sell a car. But what if you don't? And that's the problem. So what we've done is we've analyzed a number of cars that have increased in price.
Well, before you even go there, because I want to talk about that. But there's a lot more, and Hezzy, you understand this, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners understand it. There's a lot going on in the background than ever gets brought out to the public in general. This idea that there are no new cars, or there are very few new cars, what does that do to the price? It drives it up because the law of supply and demand. If you don't have many of something, it's more valuable. You know, I mean, that's reality. Now, what does that do to the used car market? It's going to drive it up as well because now a good used car worth more than it was a year ago. The problem is if you have a really good used car, and this is like what Lori was talking about, and you sell it, you have to replace it. What are you going to replace it with? You can't get a new car, and if you do, it's much more expensive than it was. And it's part of that when we went through the pandemic, which we're still seeing. You know, I think a lot of this, which is what Lori pointed out, a lot of this is just ramifications of what we went through. But remember the pandemic, what was the first thing people bought? Toilet paper. I'll never understand that one. But literally the shelves overnight, all the toilet paper is gone. And we laughed about that kind of thing, and we all made it through. But think about the mentality of people in general. There aren't new cars. I'm going to keep my old car. Now that car is more valuable. New cars are more valuable, or because they have, there are not many of them. A lot of money has been printed, just printed money. And no matter what anybody says, I think, this is just my opinion, but there has to be some inflation in there, because now the money is worth less, so you're going to have to spend more to get something that you want, that people attribute a value to, which would be like a new car. So I think we're dealing with a lot of things here, not just, you know, cars and chips and all that. Those are just outgrowth of kind of what we went through.
And, you know, you're right, Johnny, when you brought up the toilet paper, it's panic buying. So
yeah,
some dealerships are reporting that the minute they put on a listing, people are calling from 100 miles away to buy the car. The shortage is forcing some manufacturers to even cancel production of certain models. Yeah. And others are literally stripping out some of the non-critical features powered by chips just to get the cars off production lines and into dealerships. So the ramifications,
wow,
you know, that we're seeing now, these are serious. These are serious. So
tell them, before you go into some of these other things, but tell them what the biggest sales growth was in vehicles. I thought this was, because I missed it by a mile.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lori says to me, well, what kind of cars do you think are selling the most? And I go, SUVs. She goes, no, it's not. Tell them.
It's heavy-duty trucks. And the reason why is because as a result of the pandemic.
Yeah, that's what I said.
As a result of the pandemic and people being, you know, sequestered in their homes, the increase in sales of RVs and motorhomes rose like crazy. And in order to be able to pull an RV, you need a heavy-duty truck. So heavy-duty trucks lead the type of vehicle sales as a result of the pandemic, heavy-duty trucks. And so we're going to go over some vehicles here to tell you how much they've risen in price.
Well, let me tell you, let me just support what you just said.
Yeah.
This, mine's are a perfect example. My youngest, Billy, and his wife and their kids, that's what they do. They went to, I think it's Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
They went to Martha's. They're camping. They pull a little camper, that kind of thing. But that's what they do. They don't stay at hotels. They don't fly around. He gets in the car and they drive and spend a week someplace. We did that when I was a kid, you know, and that was a big deal, if you remember. But the pandemic has sort of, back on about families, has sort of brought the family together, because the least expensive and least way of contracting the COVID thing was to stay as a family unit and protect yourself.
And, you know, when we were driving back and forth to Virginia, Pennsylvania, you know, the past few months, Johnny, you've noticed the increase in number. I mean, there are so many more of these, you know, RVs that are being towed by trucks. Some of these things are as big as a small New York City apartment, square footage-wise.
Oh, yeah.
But there are so many on the roads. It's past belief. And as a result, all of these, you know, camping sites are selling out and backed up with reservations. So it's very, very interesting when you realize that the pandemic not only has changed the way we live, but how we live. And this is not an overnight sensation. This is impacting the way things go for years to come. In fact, on a separate subject, they say that the magazine publication industry will never rally in the next 10 years. It'll take 10 years before it may get up. It was before the pandemic, and likely as not, it will never see pre-pandemic circulation numbers and advertising sales. Very, very damaging.
About?
Magazines. Oh, we're talking about cars now.
Now, magazine, you're talking about the print magazine?
Yeah, print publications.
Wow.
Yeah, they say it's going to take 10 years before they rally, and they probably will never be what they were before the pandemic. So this is all very difficult. But now, let's talk about some of these cars that in 2020, last year, 2020 models, brand new, that are worth a year later, sold used. Sold used versus when they were brand new a year ago. So, Johnny, do you want to talk about the Corvette?
Well, the Corvette, the 2020 Corvette, that's the new one. that they came out with, which was, you know, the mid-engine type of European type of styling. And of course, there are fewer of them being made. So guess what? It went up $26,000. It was expensive to start with. We had one, if you'll remember.
Yeah, it was wonderful. But brand new, last year, used today, it's $26,000 more expensive.
In 2020,
wow.
a new one was $81,000, just a little over $81,000. A used one today is $107,000. A used one. Almost 25%.
25%.
Yeah.
And the reason, however, in this instance, the reason was not the semiconductor shortage, not the microchip shortage. The reason was because production was interrupted by supply chain problems.
So well, that's part of it, though.
Yeah, it surely is.
It is part of it. Yeah, that's and what did we say? Supply and demand. You know, there are not many of them. You want one. Why do you think Lamborghinis and Bugattis some of the other ones cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Very few
they
are
just
made.
Don't make many of them, right?
Very few are made. Now, one that didn't have a big increase, but an increase nonetheless, but is, you know, the poster boy for this microchip thing, is the 2020 Subaru Impreza. New, it was 22,614. Used, it's 22,838 for an increase of only $224. But this is why, because Subaru closed temporarily their Indiana plant because of the chip shortage, and instead put their focus on more profitable models such as the Outlook and the Ascent, which then took precedence for the distribution of microchips. But what did it do? It led to an increase in value for the less popular Impreza. Very interesting. And this is what's happened over and over again. Johnny, you want to talk about the Telluride, the 2020 Kia Telluride?
Yeah, that was, in fact, I'm glad you said that. That's what I was sitting here thinking about, because we love the Telluride.
Love it.
You know, that was one of the key, the Kia Telluride and the Hyundai, what is it, honey? Not the Telluride door. Hezzy, what's the other one? The Kia Telluride.
I'm thinking about
the Palisade. Right.
Yeah,
they were about the same size, a lot of similar features because both companies are kind of doing some things together. Absolutely love both of those vehicles. But the Telluride, new, is $42,000. Remember we talked about what a bargain it was for what you get for these, how much you get for this kind of money. Well, now a used one is $44,000.
And this was just updated. That was an increase of $1,400. But in 1 month, it went up even a double. It's now selling for $3,500 more used than it sold for this time last year. Why? Because it's a popular three-row SUV, and Kia is not able to keep up with the demand.
So now it's up to about $46,000 just in a month. Because those now think about all the things we talk about on these vehicles, all the safety features, all the space, the good mileage, all that you get for the money. And all of a sudden, you know, even 42 to 46, 46 doesn't sound so bad. It sounds so good that there are almost none of them you can find.
And I'm not sure about this, but I would assume that all of these great, you know, end of the year sales and manufacturers discounts are, you know, don't exist anymore.
Sure.
I mean, why should they? You know, when there's this kind of demand. One of the cars that has always been in high demand is the Civic. Now, in 2020, the Honda Civic was 22,700 new. Today, a used 2020 Honda Civic is almost $25,000. That's an increase of almost $2,000 in 1 year. And why? Because it's a bread and butter model for Honda. It's always been popular.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, there's a lot, and it still is popular. It's still in demand.
And it's still going up.
And it's experienced over 7% increase over last year from new to used.
Look at the talk about the Wrangler, because you're a Jeep
fan. Yeah, absolutely. The Jeep Wrangler Rubicon EcoDiesel, you know, came out of the gate you know, to immediate accolades. Why? Because it's a Jeep. Two, because the Rubicon's a great model, and the Eco Diesel is, you know, very desirable. Here's a diesel vehicle.
Not only gets good gas mileage, but lasts forever.
Lasts
forever. Talk about diesels, you can keep them going.
Yeah,
so
you know, Jeeps don't die. They never do. So last year, that model was 44,041 new. This year, it's almost 48,000 for an increase of about $3,500. America cannot get enough of a rugged, versatile Jeep Wrangler. They can't get enough. So, again, demand but no supply.
You know, and we'll make this very personal. I have a 2010 Ford Edge, which I love. Talked about it several times. It just turned 100,000 miles. I'm going to take it up and have them go through it. I wasn't going to get rid of it anyway, but I'm going to take it up and have them go and update everything, or, you know, replace every hoses, belt, everything, so that it's basically like a new car again, as much as I can. Well, I could have sold that car probably for $8,000 or $9,000 maybe 6 months ago. I'll bet you right now I can get $12,000 for it. I mean, it doesn't have any rust, dents.
Oh, it's
paint's good. I've always taken care of
it,
kept it garage.
Gloves, absolutely.
Yeah. Kept it washed, kept it garage, you know, changed the oil, did all those things you're supposed to do. It's a really nice vehicle. Well, I'm just telling you that this is how the mindset works for people when you're in this kind of an economy, I guess is the right word.
Now, it's true. Now, another make and model is, and one of the leaders in the SUV category since it, you know, it came out in 2002, is the 2020 Toyota 4Runner. Now,
great vehicle.
Great vehicle. New. It was $43,400 and last year, and used this year, it's $47,000 and change for an increase of almost $4,000. Now, again, it's a desirable vehicle. People want it. And so even used, they're willing to fork over $4,000 more this year than if they had bought it last year new.
Well, and the other one that I wanted to talk about was the Camaro. Mayor, we had a Camaro. And the thing I said I loved the looks of it. But driving it was kind of because the windshield seemed narrow to me. But, I mean, it's an icon. The Chevy Camaro is an icon. You buy that because you want it. I mean, it hops back to the 60s and the 70s and the muscle cars and all those kinds of things. And the Chevy Camaro, new then, was almost $38,000. Now a used one is $42,000. It's just, you know.
An increase of $4,600.
Yeah, $4,600.
And why? Because production was curtailed because of the microchip
problem. The microchip thing.
Becoming, you know, unavailable in the pandemic. And the same thing you could say, Johnny, of the 2020 Dodge Challenger RT Scat Pack.
Yeah, there's another one. That is a muscle car. I mean, those muscle cars, they don't make a whole lot of them anyway, first of all, which makes them expensive, and they're very powerful, which makes your insurance high. But the Challenger was almost $42,000, and now a used one, it's $47,000. What in the history of automotive design, development, production have we seen a place where a used one is more expensive than that year's model?
It's almost a $6,000 increase, a staggering increase of more than 12%, and again, as a result of the microchip shortage.
Yeah.
Now here we come to the, you know, 2020 Dodge Ram, the big trucks. And
well, now, just remember what you said when we were talking about this, how those things have really become the vehicle that people want, more than the SUVs. I found that hard to believe, but, I mean, I understand the logic behind it. But, I mean, if this is something people want, they want a heavy-duty vehicle, then they're willing to pay more for it if you can get one. So
here you've got this 2020 Ram 2500, which new last year was almost $57,000, used this year is almost $64,000, a staggering increase of $7,000. $7,000 buys you a pretty good used car. So for the price of...
Yeah. Well, if you could find one.
Yeah, so for a used truck and a used car, you would have paid, you know, it's crazy.
It's kind of mind-boggling.
And then, of course, the as you would figure, the Mercedes-Benz G-Class is selling for $7,500 more this year used than it did last year new. So it's a interesting
phenomena that we're actually in right now. When Lori started bringing all this to me, it was just like, go ahead, Andy. I want to hear
John,
you.
I'm sorry.
No, I want to hear what you were going to say.
I was wondering if people are buying something other that's still transportation, but something other than cars. Are they buying motorcycles? Are they buying scooters? I don't know what's going on. I've never seen so many scooters in New York ever.
I was going to say, we've seen more scooters, I think, lately, which are dangerous. I mean, I just think they're dangerous, and I'm sure people that own them don't. But my father said, now this is a long time ago, but my father said to me, when a motorcycle meets a car, the motorcycle always loses.
Right.
And I've always thought about that, you know.
Do you know what's even more remarkable?
No.
Our time is up. How did that go so fast? It always does with you, Hezzy. Our time is up.
I don't know. Well, I'll take the blame. It's always exciting to talk to you guys.
Yeah. Well, you got a little dose of cars in life today, that's for sure.
And next week we have a little pocket rocket that we'll be reviewing, but we'll save the surprise for you till next week. How about that?
Okay, a pocket rocket. That one I'm going to try to figure out when I know I'll never be able to come up with.
All right. You have a good week.
Have a
Stay
great
cool.
morning.
Everybody have a good
All
week, a healthy week, a happy week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You
now.
Too. Thank you. Bye. Oh, always excited to speak to John and Lori Wiles. I don't know how they do it, but they keep on doing it, which is really terrific. Well, let me quickly go over to the studio screen. We're going to cover some national and international news. Start off with local stuff first. Bear with me a moment. This is very interesting. New York City is going to require hospital workers to get vaccinated or get it weekly. Well, as part of a nationwide response to the threat posed by the more contagious Delta coronavirus variant, New York City is going to require COVID-19 vaccinations or weekly tests for workers at city-run hospitals and clinics. So the new policy will go into effect on August 2nd. That's what Mayor Bill de Blasio said at a news conference yesterday. And the city will suspend without pay any employee who refuses to either get vaccinated or test sick. And because of the Delta variant, increasingly the choice is between infection or vaccination. And that can mean the difference between life and death. That's what Dave Shockshi, the city's health commissioner, said at the same briefing. About 60% of the more than 42,000 employees of New York City's public hospital system are vaccinated. Mitch Katz, who heads the nation's largest public health care system, said on Wednesday, across New York City, 70% of hospital staff have received both doses of the vaccine, state data shows. And the percentage of New York public hospital workers who are fully vaccinated is also lower than the percentage of the city's adult population, which stands at 65%. The city health data showed that as well. So the requirement marks the first time City Hall has mandated vaccinations or negative tests for public sector workers. In California, San Francisco took more decisive steps last month when it announced that all municipal workers in high-risk settings, such as homeless shelters and jails, will have to get vaccinated by September 15th. Well, de Blasio said that New York may take further measures. If the threat posed by the Delta variant grows, he did not rule out extending vaccination or test requirements to all city workers in the future. The highly contagious Delta variant that originated in India and has now become the dominant strain worldwide has been wreaking havoc among the nation's unvaccinated population in recent weeks. U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Rochelle Walensky said last week that 97% of people entering hospitals in the United States with COVID-19 are, I hope you're sitting down for this, unvaccinated. Well, there is a new influx of cases. Dozens of hospitals and health systems across the United States have issued vaccination requirements for their staff. Last month, a federal judge dismissed a lawsuit brought by a group of workers at Houston Methodist Hospital in Texas over its requirement that they be vaccinated against COVID-19. A large medical system in New Jersey has fired half a dozen employees because they did not get vaccinated against COVID-19, according to media reports published on Tuesday. Several states with low vaccination rates, such as Utah, Arkansas, and Louisiana, are once again facing outbreaks, and some hospitals warn they are overwhelmed by the influx of COVID-19 patients. We have an alarming spike in the number of COVID-19 cases across the Houston area. Patty Muck, a spokesperson for Texas Houston Methodist, said in an email earlier this week, the increased hospitalization adds stress to many of our hospitals that are nearing capacity. Coronavirus cases have nearly tripled over the last month, and hospitalizations are up nearly 40%, according to analysis of Reuters data deaths, which can lag behind other indicators, were down 14% over the same period of time last year. So very, very interesting stuff that's going on. So we're going to cover some of these things maybe out of order. This is very interesting. The Tokyo opening ceremony director has been fired on the eve of the Olympics over a Holocaust skit. Well, on the eve of the Tokyo Games, organizers fired the director of the opening ceremony over comments he made about the Holocaust, while media reported former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, a memorable advocate for the Tokyo Games, would skip the showpiece event. The news is the latest in a series of embarrassments for Tokyo organizers that have sparked outrage at home and abroad, and comes just days after a well-known musician was forced to step down as composer for the ceremony after old reports of his bullying and abusive behavior surfaced. Abe, who famously dressed up as the titular plumber from video game Super Mario at the Rio Games to represent Japan, played an outsized role in attracting the Olympics to Tokyo. In a speech in front of a banquet room full of International Olympic Committee members back in 2013, that the lingering nuclear disaster at Fukushima was under control, and pitched his nation as a passionate, proud, and a strong believer in the Olympics. At the time, Abe and his supporters hoped the Olympics would parallel the 1964 Tokyo Games, heralding the nation's revival after decades of economic stagnation, and also mark its recovery from a devastating nuclear and natural disaster back in 2011. Instead, the Games, delayed a year because of the global pandemic, has forced a series of setbacks, or rather faced a series of setbacks, including the exit of Yoshiro Mori, the former head of the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee, who resigned after making sexist remarks. That was soon followed by the resignation of Tokyo Olympic creative head Hiroshi Sasaki after he made derogatory comments about a popular Japanese female entertainer. Well, the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee said Kentaro Kobayashi, who is listed as a show director for the game's opening event, was fired after a joke he made about the Holocaust as part of his comedy act in 1998 resurfaced in domestic media. The Simon Wiesenthal Center, an international Jewish human rights group organization, had earlier released a statement condemning Kobayashi's past behavior. Quote, any association of this person to the Tokyo Olympics would insult the memory of 6 million Jews and made a cruel mockery of the Paralympics, said Abraham Cooper, a rabbi and associate dean and global social action director of the center. Well, the opening ceremony on Friday, which normally stands as a major showcase of, to the local nation, is set to be a subdued affair, with Japanese media reporting that less than 950 people, including only about 15 global leaders, are set to attend. First Lady Jill Biden is expected to land in Tokyo on Thursday afternoon for the Games opening ceremony. Raising expectations, she might also use her attendance to discuss vaccines with Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. Now, Biden has been traveling across the United States, urging more people in the country to get inoculated. Only a third of Japanese have at least one dose of the vaccine, fueling public concerns that the Olympics could become a super spreader event. Already dozens of attendees have tested positive for COVID-19, forcing athlete withdrawals and teammates into isolation. NHK said, the news agency said that Abe decided against attending the ceremony after the Japanese government declared a state of emergency and virus restrictions over Tokyo in an effort to minimize health risks among residents and visitors. Abe's office could not immediately be reached on Thursday, a public holiday in Japan. COVID-19 infections have jumped in the capital and are projected to spike further, straining healthcare providers. In a recent poll in the Asahi newspaper, 68% of respondents expressed doubt about the ability of Olympic organizers to control coronavirus infections, with 55% saying they oppose the games going ahead. Well, Olympics competition has already begun, and the Japanese women's softball team getting their host off to a winning start on Wednesday, while the highly ranked U.S. women's soccer team were upset by Sweden. Well, the second day of softball began early Thursday under cloudy skies in Fukushima, with the United States defeating Canada by a run of 2-0 in the standings, and Japan faces Mexico later on. So we'll see where that goes. Now, let me just see here. One moment. And this is important. This also happened here in the United States. Drug companies and U.S. states have reached a $26 billion settlement over the opioid crisis. Prosecutors from several U.S. states on Wednesday unveiled a sweeping proposed settlement under which four pharmaceutical companies accused of fueling the country's opioid epidemic would pay up to $26 billion to resolve thousands of claims in federal and state courts. Under the proposed agreement, three drug distributors, McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen, along with drug maker Johnson & Johnson, would pay to resolve some 4,000 claims, as well as finance prevention and treatment programs, said New York Attorney General Letitia James. The proposed settlement is the largest unveiled in the multi-year legal effort to hold the industry accountable for the opioid crisis, which has caused more than 500,000 deaths in the United States in the last 20 years. Well, the numerous companies that manufactured and distributed opioids across the nation did so without regard to life or even the national crisis they were helping to fuel, James said in a statement. Well, today we are holding these companies accountable and infusing tens of billions of dollars into communities across the nation. James told reporters that the settlement covered civil cases, but did decline to comment on whether criminal charges were still possible. People are dying. At least two states, the state of Washington and West Virginia, criticized the agreement and vowed to continue litigation. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson said the proposed $527.5 million payoff to his state over 18 years was not a transformative amount of money and is not sufficient to address the opioids crisis devastation. West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, who settled previously with three distributors but still has a case open against Johnson & Johnson, said that the agreement shortchanges smaller states by supporting funds, by apportioning funds, rather, on the basis of population rather than the intensity of the opioid crisis. The prosecutors supporting the agreement said they expect most states would welcome a chance to for immediate funds. We want to get these monies in our communities as quickly as possible and to the maximum amount possible because people are dying. And we want to save lives, said North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein. He said he expects more than 40 states will support the settlement. Besides New York and North Carolina, the states of Connecticut, Delaware, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee have already signed the deal. Well, the settlement does not address legal cases against Teva, it's an Israeli pharmaceutical firm, Allergan, nor does it address the role of drugstore chains such as Walgreens or CVS that have also been sued. Under the agreement, Johnson & Johnson agreed to pay up to $5 billion over 9 years and to stop selling opioids nationwide, James had said. The three distributors will pay up to $21 billion over 8 years and agreed to set up a centralized clearinghouse to help state officials track drug shipments and better guard against suspicious orders. The exact amount will be determined by overall participation of state and local governments, according to James' statement. The three distributors described a process where first the states and then localities would have a chance to support the agreement. At each stage, each of the three companies will independently determine whether there is enough support to proceed. While the companies strongly dispute the allegations made in these lawsuits, they believe the proposed settlement agreement and deferred and settlement process it establishes are important steps toward achieving a broad resolution of government's opioid claims and delivering meaningful relief to communities across the United States, the companies had said. Well, McKesson would pay up to $7.9 billion, while the other two companies would each be responsible for up to $6.4 billion. Johnson & Johnson's general counsel, Michael Ullman, said that the proposed settlement will directly support state and local efforts to make meaningful progress in addressing the opioid crisis in the United States. Shares of all four companies gained as investors greeted the chance of removing uncertainty surrounding the price of liability. Shares of Johnson & Johnson rose 0.6% to $169.40. McKesson gained 1.6% to $197.54. AmerisourceBergen climbed 1.5% to $118.22, and Cardinal Health advanced 1.6% to $58.60. Very, very interesting, to say the least. Bear with me a moment here. Oh, 1 second. And this is really interesting. It seems like there's so many places around the world where, you know, people are being killed. You know, people in political office are being killed and ransacked and who knows what. Well, Madagascar, the island off of Africa, said that several people were arrested over a foiled plot to kill the president. The prosecutors in Madagascar said that on Thursday they had foiled an attempt to assassinate President Andry Rajoelina and made several arrests. Several foreign and Madagascar nationals were arrested on Tuesday, July 20, as part of an investigation into an attack on state security. That's what Prosecutor Bertin Rassasiavivoni said in a statement released on overnight. There was a plan to eliminate and neutralize various Madagascar figures, including the head of state, Rassasiavivoni had said. At this stage of the investigation, which is ongoing, the prosecutor general's office assures we will shed it on the case, she added. Two French nationals among those who were arrested on Tuesday, diplomatic sources advised. And the two suspects are reputedly retired military officers, according to the Taracha, a local news agency operation to the communications ministry. And during the country's Independence Day celebration on June 26th, the Gendarmerie, or the police, announced that they had foiled an assassination attempt to their boss, General Richard Ravalomanana, who is also Rajo Elina's right-hand man. Rajo Elina, 47, first seized power in March of 2009 from Mare Ravalomanana with the backing of the military. He won the last vote in December 2018, beating his main rival and predecessor, Ravalomanana, in an election beset by allegations of fraud. The former French colony has had a long history of coups and uncertain unrest and uncertainty since gaining independence from France in 1960. Well, the island is internationally famed for its unique wildlife, or made famous by its unique wildlife and vanilla, but is heavily dependent on foreign aid. 9 out of 10 people live on less than $2 a day. The country has been under a lockdown since the COVID-19 pandemic hit last year, and its southern region is in the grips of a famine. All these things happen. It's amazing all over the world. Now let's look at what's happening in the United Kingdom. Evidently, the Prime Minister Johnson says that post-Brexit deal, the trade deal for Northern Ireland, is unsustainable. So British Prime Minister Boris Johnson urged the European Union on Thursday to look seriously at UK proposals to overhaul their post-Brexit deal, trade deal for Northern Ireland, but met immediate resistance in Brussels. Johnson told European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in a phone call that the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol is unsustainable and requires significant changes. In a 28-page paper published on Wednesday, Johnson's government demanded the European Union negotiate, or rather renegotiate, the protocol for Northern Ireland after rioting and business disruption has plagued the province. He urged the European Union to look at those proposals seriously and work with the United Kingdom on them, a Downing Street spokesman said shortly after the conversation. But in a tweet released around the same time, von der Leyen said she had made clear the bloc's opposition to reworking the pact, which came into effect earlier this year. The European Union will continue to be creative and flexible within the protocol framework, she said, or we will not renegotiate. In its proposals, London stopped short of suspending the protocol, which requires checks on goods arriving from mainland Britain, and instead called for significant changes. It wants the European Union to indefinitely abandon ad hoc grace periods for certain border checks and freeze legal action launched against the UK for non-compliance as part of a standstill period allowing for fresh negotiations. It also wants more input on regulations being adopted in the province and the removal of any oversight role by the European Court of Justice. Well, the arrangements were negotiated to avoid a hard border with Ireland by effectively keeping Northern Ireland in the European Union's single market. Northern Ireland, which suffered 3 decades of sectarian conflict until a peace agreement in 1998, has been rocked by violence this year, in part against the protocol. And many pro-UK unionists see it as creating a de facto border in the Irish Sea with mainland Britain and say they feel betrayed, while many businesses, especially supermarkets, are struggling to adapt to the new rules. So we'll have to see where all this goes. Very, very intriguing stuff. Well, let's move on. Bear with me a moment here. Okay, now this is very interesting because I didn't expect this would continue, but more than 230 migrants have entered Spain's Melilla enclave from Morocco. It seems that more than 230 migrants crossed the Moroccan border into Spain's Melilla or Melilla enclave before dawn on Thursday, and one of the largest influxes into this tiny North African territory in recent years. The incident occurred 2 months after an unprecedented 10,000 people surged into Spain's other enclave of Ceuta, exacerbating a diplomatic crisis between Madrid and Rabat. Rabat is the capital of Morocco. So in a statement, the Spanish government delegation in Melilla said that a huge influx of more than 300 migrants had tried to cross the frontier at 6:50 a.m. local time, with 238 of them successfully scaling the fence, all of them men. It said they used hooks to scale the frontier, which they managed to do despite the fact that the border fence was equipped with anti-intrusion measures without specifying what they were. The three Guardia civil police officers suffered slight injuries from the hooks used by those crossing the fence, it said. The migrants were taken to a reception center along where they will still be quarantined in line with the civil service or with the anti-COVID safety procedures. Well, since mid-May, hundreds of migrants have tried to rush the Moroccan border fence into Melilla, with nearly 300 of them making it across. Thursday's incident raised that number to more than 500 in just over 2 months. Spain's two tiny enclaves of Ceuta and Melilla have Europe's only land border with Africa, making them a magnet for migrants desperate to escape grinding poverty and hunger. Over the years, thousands of migrants have attempted to cross the 12 kilometers, that's about a 7.5-mile border, between Melilla and Morocco, or Ceuta's 8-kilometer border, it's a little bit over a mile, by climbing the fences, swimming along the coast, or hiding in vehicles. Now, the two territories are protected by fences fortified with barbed wire, video cameras, and watchtowers. Claimed by Morocco, the two cities have long been a flashpoint in diplomatic relations between Rabat and Madrid, which insists both are integral parts of Spain. And in mid-May, Spain was caught off guard when more than 10,000 people swam or used small inflatable boats to cross into Ceuta, a territory, as the Moroccan border forces looked the other way. Although most were quickly sent back, there were still more than 2,000 left inside the enclave. Among them, 1,185 unaccompanied minors, a spokesman for the government delegation in Ceuta had advised. That was today. Well, the influx took place during a diplomatic crisis between Madrid and Rabat over Western Sahara, which has long been pushed for independence from Morocco. Well, Madrid had angered Morocco by allowing the leader of Western Sahara's independence movement into Spain for hospital treatment for a severe case of COVID-19, sparking a touchy standoff between the two countries. And the unprecedented border breach was widely seen as a punitive move by Rabat. Now, although Polisario Front leader Brahim Hali left Spain on June 2nd, diplomatic relations have remained tense. So we'll have to see where all that goes. Bear with me a second here. Now, And this is interesting with respect to Afghanistan. Former military interpreters live in fear of being returned to, for the country to return to Taliban rule. So as the Taliban gained ground throughout Afghanistan, Afghans have worked as interpreters for foreign countries, are living in fear of reprisals. Perceived as traitors by the Taliban, they've been imploring Western nations to grant them a visa so they can flee the country. And although the Taliban say no harm will be done to former interpreters who show remorse, Afghans who worked for foreign forces find it difficult to believe this promise, and so we'll just have to see where all that goes. But I guess they're probably going to be very scared unless they were able to leave the country and settle elsewhere. So bear with me a moment here. Okay, 1 second. What is this? Well, this is interesting, too, because it sounds similar to what's happening in the United States. Seems that conspiracy theories are fueling French opposition to COVID-19 health pass. So, you know what we've done here yet? Seems that more than 100,000 people rallied across France on Saturday to protest President Emmanuel Macron's plans to require a COVID-19 health pass to access public places such as cafes and cinemas starting next week. In addition to traditional concerns about curtailed civil rights, liberties, conspiracy theories have fueled the opposition to make proof of vaccination obligatory. Starting on July 21, which was yesterday, a health pass, pass sanitaire, will be needed to access any of France's leisure and cultural venues serving more than 50 people, including cinemas and museums. And from the beginning of August, the pass will be required on any long-distance public transport in shopping centers or at cafes and restaurants, including on France's famed outdoor terraces. Well, the pass must either include the QR code that proves someone has been fully vaccinated in France or results from a negative PCR or antigen test taken in the previous 48 hours. France's COVID-19 infection rate has rebounded alarmingly as the more contagious Delta variant has spread, with the average number of new cases confirmed per day soaring to nearly 11,000 from fewer than 2,000 in late June. Well, the uptick prompted Macron to announce the health pass restrictions on July 12th. But the move has provoked serious opposition among many in France, since 137 rallies took place across the country on Saturday, gathering nearly 114,000 demonstrators, including 18,000 in Paris alone, according to the Interior Ministry. Many appear to have taken to the streets out of a libertarian belief that obliging people to be vaccinated if they want to access public venues and activities is an infringement on their basic rights. In no way does a president have the right to decide on my individual health, said one Paris protester who gave her name as Christelle, had told Reuters, the news agency. Well, Lucille is a young shop manager demonstrating in Paris, told Associated Press he was by no means an anti-vaxxer, but that the state should not effectively coerce people to get inoculated. The government is going too far, he said. Some mainstream politicians have echoed these arguments. François Xavier Bellamy, a prominent young minister of European Parliament for the Conservative, the Republican Party, and Louis Hervé, a vice president of the Senate's centrist bloc, penned a joint opinion piece in Le Figaro this week in which they said or laid out their reasons for opposing the measure. Opposing the health pass does not make someone an anti-vaxxer, he said. The essential problem with the pass is that for the first time in our history, people will have to present a document in order to do the most simple, ordinary thing. Well, there seems to be extremes on both sides, but most of the political opposition to the health pass have come from extremes on both sides of the political spectrum. Macron's party backed a nationwide strike, and one second. I lost my place here. Well, LSI firebrand Francois Ruffin went further on Friday as he urged people to rally, characterizing the health pass as a means of humiliation coming from an absolute monarchy in the form of Macron's government. And that's what Florian Patriot's party declared ahead of Saturday's protest, that they would demonstrate the power of the people in the face of disgrace. So we'll have to see where all that goes, but it looks like battle royale. Let me check now. One second, I'll go back to the studio screen for a moment. Okay, here we are. We'll be right back after this commercial from the Cabot Creamer.
Hey, you a judge?
Well, sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, welcome back. It seems that the Tokyo Olympics revealed that female athletes face a double standard over uniforms. So this is going to be very, very interesting. I think you'll find it most interesting. It seems that the Norwegian women's beach handball team were fined because their shorts were too long. That's what the British Paralympian Olivia Breen was told by an official, that her briefs were too short. Big swimmer Alice Deering won't be allowed to wear a swimming cap for natural black hair at the 2021 Olympic Olympics. The Tokyo Olympics. Well, ahead of the games, which are going to start tomorrow, female athletes are being scrutinized for their choice of sportswear. 2021 Tokyo Olympics haven't even begun, and the run-up is already fraught with debate on what female athletes should or shouldn't wear. Double Paralympic world champion Olivia Breen is the latest Olympic athlete to be caught in a sartorial storm. After competing in the long jump in the English Championship in Bedford on July 18th, an official said her briefs were too short and inappropriate. She said to me that I should consider wearing shorts because my briefs were too revealing, Green had said. I was so taken by surprise and gobsmacked that I asked her if she was joking. She said no and insisted I should buy a pair of shorts. While writing about the incident in a Twitter post, Breen pointed to a double standard regarding athletic dress codes and questioned whether male athletes would be subjected to the same level of scrutiny. "I've been wearing the same style sprint briefs for many years," she said in her post. "I recognize that there needs to be regulations and guidelines in relation to competition kits, but women should not be made to feel self-conscious about what they are wearing when competing. They should just feel comfortable and at ease." Well, the 24-year-old said she was in full compliance with athletic uniform regulations, which allow athletes in her department to wear sponsor gear, those are the briefs, as long as they also don a club vest or a national kit, and their outfits cannot be objectionable or see-through. "It's 2021. It's not the 18th century," she said. "I shouldn't be told what I can and can't wear." Well, Breen filed an official complaint to England Athletics on Monday, but says she hasn't heard anything back. The young athlete is set to take part in the Tokyo Paralympics this August and intends on wearing the contentious briefs. "I'm not letting them stop me from wearing them. I will be wearing them in Tokyo," she said. Well, Breen's case is in no way singular. Alice Deering, the first black swimmer ever to represent Team Great Britain at the Olympic Games, will not be allowed to wear the swimming cap made specifically for natural black hair she has been promoting. Well, earlier this month, the International Swimming Federation, the FINA, banned the use of swimming cap made specifically to protect dreadlocks, afros, weaves, braids, and thick curly hair for the 2021 Games. Solcap, the company behind the swimming caps, were told by FINA that it was because their product doesn't fit the natural form of the head. In yet another effort to sanction female athletes for their uniforms, the European Handball Federation fined the Norwegian women's beach handball team €1,500 for wearing shorts instead of bikini bottoms at the Euro 2021 championship. Calling it a case of improper clothing, the European Handball Federation said that players didn't abide by athletes' uniform regulations, which require women to wear bikini bottoms with a close fit and cut on an upward angle toward the top of the leg, and are determined by the National Handball Federation. Male beach handball players, on the other hand, are free to wear shorts as long as 10 centimeters above the knee, just as long as they aren't too baggy. Well, the team had approved the European Handball Federation before the competition, asked for permission to play in shorts. They were told that any breach of protocol would be met with fines. And although beach handball isn't part of the 2021 Olympic Games in Tokyo, it's a stark reminder of the glaring double standards held with athletic uniform regulations as and when they're devised. The question is, who's going to decide? Well, the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, the authority in charge of organizing the Olympic Games, said it is not responsible for establishing and enforcing uniform regulations. Instead, it's up to international federations, to each individual sport, to decide what the appropriate attire for each gender group is. Well, according to the most recent Olympic Charter published by the IOC, they have the sole and exclusive authority to prescribe and determine the clothing and uniforms to be worn and the equipment to be used by the members of their delegation on the occasion of Olympic Games. Well, Helen Jefferson-Lenski, a professor at the University of Toronto and author of The Olympic Games, A Critical Approach, says that uniform decisions are based on either practical consideration related to the demands of the sport, and traditional routes like the GI or for martial arts, or gender differentiation. And some federations also argue that their decisions are purely based on performance or that they ensure fairness. Lenski sees clear gender discrimination at play, especially given that many federations are still largely run by men. In sports judged on aesthetics like figure skating have clothing rules consistent with judges' often stereotypical views of what a feminine skater should look like, and women's beach volleyball uniform regulations are based solely on heterosexual sex appeal, she said. What's clear is that Janice Forsythe, the former director of Western University International Center for Olympic Studies in Ontario, said, the international federations try to appeal to what they think is a heterosexual male audience and try to titillate them into watching women's sports, arguing that it raises interest, thereby making it more lucrative by potentially attracting sponsors and TV contracts or even corporate sponsorship for athletes. If motivated, International Federation could move quickly to change uniform regulations for women. The fact that they choose not to, according to Forsythe, is purely for marketing reasons. Not every Olympic sport is stuck in the 18th century, as Paralympic star Olivia Breen put it, but many have a history of controversy when it comes to female athletic uniform regulations. Swimming athletics, badminton, boxing, gymnastics, and beach volleyball, for example, have particularly poor track records. Just before the 2012 London Olympics, the Amateur International Boxing Association tried to make female boxers wear skirts instead of shorts. Their reasoning was that spectators would be able to discern more easily between female and male boxers, as they couldn't tell the difference before. The suggestion sparked outrage in an online petition started by amateur London-based boxer Elizabeth Plank, demanded that women be free to choose what they wear in the ring. And after garnering more than 57,000 signatures, the decision was amended, and female boxers were free to choose between shorts or a skirt. And that same year, the International Volleyball Federation changed its dress code. Before the amendment, women players were forced to wear bikinis or bodysuits during games. The public pressure mounted after the International Volleyball Federation published new rules allowing women to wear shorts and sleeved tops out of respect for religious and cultural requirements of some participating countries. In 2011, the Badminton World Federation were less forgiving about their uniform requirements. So ahead of the London Olympics, the following year, the organization decided the female athletes playing at an elite level must wear dresses or skirts. They defended their decision, saying they would create a more attractive presentation. Recent sartorial debates are just the latest hurdle for human athletes, particularly when it comes to the Olympic Games. And women were barred from joining the Games for decades and even subjected to gender testing. And even though the IOC openly promotes inclusivity, female athletes are still subjected to more scrutiny than their male counterparts. We're just scratching the surface, Forsythe from Western University says. If we're just talking about and debating uniforms, imagine what we're going to find if we dig a little deeper. So that's going to be very interesting to see where that all goes. Now, let me just quickly look, see what else is happening here. Okay, we have one story that's coming out of Iran, southwestern Iran. It seems that protests over water shortages have turned deadly. So bear with me a second as we reach that page. It seems that protesters are angry about water shortages, and they took to the streets of southwest Iran for a sixth night in a row this past Tuesday, with mounting violence while Tehran residents chanted anti-government slogans, according to videos posted on social media on Wednesday and Iranian news outlets. Videos uploaded by social media users showed that security forces using tear gas to disperse protesters, and the semi-official FARS, F-A-R-S, news agency said that rioters, quote-unquote, shot dead one policeman and injured another in the port city of Malahar in oil-rich Khuzestan province. So that's very interesting there. Don't want to get too complex about it, but they're having a drought, and it's a very bad one. One second here. This is what the last thing I wanted to do. After successfully managing the first wave of COVID-19, Tunisia is in its most intense period of crisis since the outbreak of the pandemic. Scenes in hospitals in Tunis are chaotic, with medical personnel saying they are completely overwhelmed and that there aren't enough of them to handle the massive number of patients. So faced with shortages of oxygen and other material, doctors are forced to make wrenching choices about who to treat. Officials are pinning hopes on the accelerating vaccine campaign, but a convention center in Tunis has been pressed into use as a vaccination site is where they're focusing, especially with regard to elderly people. The only way forward is to vaccinate everyone, said a doctor working at the site. It won't be easy, but we hope to vaccinate 50 to 60% of the population, he said. He expected they would be able to reach that level within 3 months. That goal may be optimistic, though, as many are still expressing skepticism about being vaccinated. So that seems to be a problem all over the world. There's such reluctance in so many places. It's amazing. Let's take a quick look in the last few minutes. Pilgrims have arrived in Mecca, the second Hajj of the COVID-19 pandemic. So an Indian family of five burst into tears of joy after being chosen for this weekend's downsized Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia, but hundreds of thousands of rejected applicants were left disappointed. Up to 60,000 Muslims residing in Saudi Arabia are allowed to take part in this year's Hajj, evoking the envy and awe of millions of international pilgrims who have been barred for the second year due to the COVID pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic. So through an online vetting system, they were chosen for more than 558,000 applicants, all citizens or residents of the kingdom. The annual Hajj is a ritual and is a central pillar of Islam, and a must for able-bodied Muslims at least once in their lifetime. Among the chosen ones are Amin, a 58-year-old Indian oil contractor based in the eastern city of Dammam, who was picked for the ritual along with his wife and three adult children. "We were overjoyed," said Amin, who only gave his first name. "So many of our friends and relatives were rejected," he said. 5-day pilgrimage, which starts on Saturday, is confined to residents of the kingdom who have been fully vaccinated and are aged between 18 to 65 with no chronic illnesses, the Hajj ministry had said. The chosen pilgrims come from 150 countries, with a preference given to those performing the ritual for the first time about it. I feel like I won a lottery, Egyptian pharmacist Mohammed El Eter said after being selected. This is a special, unforgettable moment in one's life. I thank God for granting me this chance to be accepted among a lot of people who applied, the 31-year-old had advised. The Hajj ministry also received inquiries and with anguished queries on Twitter from rejected applicants about the tightly controlled government lottery. We are still anxiously awaiting to be accepted as though we're facing an exam, wrote one Twitter user. All Muslims are expected to complete the Hajj for to the holy city of Mecca at least once in their lives if they have the means to do so. Meanwhile, believers converge on the city for several days of rituals in which they retrace the Prophet Muhammad's last pilgrimage. In a huge, sensitive decision last year, Saudi authorities hosted the smallest Hajj in modern history to prevent it from becoming a super spreader event for the deadly virus. Authorities initially said that only 1,000 pilgrims were allowed last year. The local media said up to 10,000 took part. Well, though a higher number of pilgrims were chosen this year, it is still a far cry from the 2.5 million who participated in 2019 from around the world. I'm profoundly saddened, Pakistani clothes merchant Zafar Ula, 64, advised after Saudi Arabia announced it was barring international pilgrims. I also wanted to go for a Hajj last year. I was desperately hoping to make it this year, and even that got myself vaccinated along with my wife. So even among the chosen pilgrims, some complained of the high cost of the ritual. Government Hajj packages start around 12,100 riyals. That's about $3,200, excluding a value added tax. Last year, worshippers said that the Saudi government covered the expenses of all pilgrims, providing them with meals, hotel accommodations, and health care. Despite the cost, applicants said that to be among the chosen ones adds an aura of religious prestige to the pilgrimage. Amid the pandemic, many pilgrims consider it is safer to participate in a smaller ritual without the usual colossal crowds cramming into tiny religious sites, creating logistical nightmares and a health hazard. Even in a regular year, the Hajj leaves pilgrims exposed to a host of viral diseases and illnesses. My feelings cannot be described, said Rania Azraq, a 38-year-old Syrian housewife in Riyadh, who will attend the Hajj without a mass guardian, without a male guardian, once mandatory for female pilgrims. You just want to cry and move closer to God. So that's her. That's what she said. And very compelling. So bear with me a second here. We'll move to our studio screen in a moment. One second. And this. And now this. And it seems our guests are already on. Good morning, ladies. How are you? Well, let me see. I think we're waiting for Alyssa Satin Cappuccilli and Dawn Greenberg. Oh, I see there's another caller coming in. So we'll say hello. Good morning.
Good morning. It's Alyssa Satin Cappuccilli.
How are you, Alyssa Satin Cappuccilli?
Very well. How are you?
I pronounced it correctly. Okay. And then is Dawn Greenberg, are you on the line already? I think so, but maybe she's away. Well, I'm very impressed.
I'm here. I'm sorry. I'm trying to get away from the tree work that my neighbors are doing naturally.
Oh.
Normally
okay.
A quiet neighborhood.
Well, that's all right. There's always something new happens every day. and every moment. Right? Well, I'm glad to welcome you back. It's been, I think, over a year since we last spoke, Ms. Greenberg.
Yeah, I think it was
so
2 years.
It's always a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Is it 2 years?
Thank you.
My God. Oh, yeah. My God. Well, it feels only like last week, if you must know.
It doesn't.
I think about
it really
you
does.
Often because of the Chappaqua Children's Book Festival that you founded years ago. And are you bringing it back this year?
We are. It took a lot of soul-stretching and analysis and, planning, but we are. We'll be back on October 2nd.
And I had not realized that Alyssa Satin Capocilli, who's on the line with us already, that she's one of your favorite authors. And I'm astounded she wrote 100 books. Absolutely. Where did you get the time to do this? I mean, do you actually live, eat, breathe, sleep, whatever, while you're writing 100 books?
Well, I have to say it's been done over a number of years, but, you know, my children who are now quite grown up might recall one or two grilled cheese sandwiches too many when I was very busy, writing the stories and developing them. But I think it's all good for sure.
So maybe you could tell us, how did you and Dawn Greenberg get together?
Sure. We've connected, of course, through books and being book lovers. Dawn and her team created an amazing event in this Chappaqua Children's Book Festival that gathers together a collective community celebrating the skill, the lifelong skill of reading and writing. There's this palpable feeling that books and reading and writing are something to be energized and excited about. And I have just been so very, very fortunate that they have welcomed me and my characters and many, many other authors and illustrators to share in this really amazing event.
Truly is amazing. Well, Ms. Greenberg, when I reflect back to 2 years ago, I didn't realize it was that long ago, I was astounded that there was such a need for people to, young people particularly, to engage in reading. I guess because that was the beginning of the COVID crisis, so a lot of kids didn't go, and the libraries were closing. Sometimes it was a monetary issue. Parents couldn't always buy books. What caused you to open up the Chappaqua Children's Book Festival, and what was the rationale for it?
Well, the original plan back in 2013 came out of the sad fact that the Sunnyside Children's Book Festival went away. So to me, it seemed a natural thing for us to take on in Chappaqua because, you know, we love our kids, we love our schools, they're our pride and joy, and it just seemed, you know, this would be a beautiful kind of bucolic place to have a book festival on a rolling lawn. And, you know,
yeah,
it worked better than we could ever have dreamed. It really did.
And how has been the revival of the festival? How has that come about? Are there hurdles for that too?
Yeah, we really, last year, we acutely wanted to do something virtual, and we just couldn't bring ourselves to do it. We felt like our kids were already in front of screens, you know, all week long doing virtual school, so we just couldn't do virtual this year. And the minute we felt we could do this safely, largely because of the vaccinations, going as low as 12 years old, we started planning. Could we do it? Could we spread out the authors a great deal more, you know, require masks, ask that all of our authors and volunteers be vaccinated? Because we feel like there's such a need right now for a sense of community. And I feel like it's going to be almost a double celebration when we get together on October 2nd. Celebrating reading,
seems
but
like
also just celebrating that we're back.
It's fascinating because it seems like you're the mother of this festival and you're taking care of so many kids under your guidance.
Yes.
How do you, you know, Well, it's which is perfect. That's always the rationale for it. Ms. Capicilli, what is so, I haven't read Biscuit. I almost feel, you know, like ignorant because I had never heard of it, but it's one of your most popular bestsellers. I'm going to have to read it.
You have
point.
To.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I'm embarrassed to admit it, you know, but I have to tell it the way it is. So what is that? What is Biscuit about?
Biscuit is a story about the first Biscuit book. There are many in our series now, but it's really a love story between a child and her puppy, and that child helping that puppy get comfortable before bedtime. It's filled with, you know, a nurturing and loving character. And the reason that Biscuit has really become, as you noted, best-selling, which was truly a surprise to me, was that it became a book that children learned to read all by themselves. And what many children would go on to say was the first book that they could read independently. And because of that, it was embraced by teachers and parents and librarians, and I can really pinch myself because sometimes it's really hard to imagine, but in meeting children and being at festivals where I can meet my young readers, there's this just wonderful added bonus where children say to me, this is the first book I can read to myself, and they read to me. And learning to read is really a big deal. It's a wonderful, it's a lifelong skill, and that Biscuit could be even a small part of kids loving to learn to read is just immensely gratifying. So this year we're actually celebrating our 25th year of Biscuit. So we've had a couple of generations now learning to read with Biscuit, which is just awesome.
How do you define that a child that picks up one of these, my first I can read series of books, which Biscuit was the first, what makes it possible for them to read on their own? Do they already know the alphabet? So, or are they just totally ignorant of everything? Are there pictures? Is that how it makes it palatable?
Absolutely. There is a direct, first of all, yes, they probably do know, their alphabet, although the way we teach reading today is really so varied between, you know, reading phonetically and reading whole words. But the books are, you know, beautifully crafted so that illustration and text support each other. And that has really been a key in making Biscuit one that children like to read. For my part, I try to really craft a story, not just words, you know, that may be linked together or rhyme or so forth, but a story so that even the youngest can grasp onto story and character, and they start to know the world of Biscuit. So, for example, the very first book about Biscuit had two characters, Biscuit and a young child who loves him and cares for him wonderfully well. But now our world has expanded. We've added friends, we've added family, we've added neighbors, we've added community. So it's just something that started as sort of this very small moment and has really expanded to its own world.
Very, very fascinating. To go back to Ms. Greenberg, how do you stay on top of all the different authors recognizing the books that would be conducive to, you know, the population of readers that you attract, and has it, and it has, and you have expanded beyond just Chappaqua, and you did an unbelievable job the last 2 years in reaching out to people who didn't have an opportunity to read a book, and that must have caused a tremendous upsurge of kids going to the library or parents buying books. How did you put this all together?
Okay, well, originally the Sunnyside Festival had, I think, about 60 authors. So we pulled a lot from there. We put the word out. I was so surprised the other day. I heard from Chris Barton, who lives in Texas, who wants to come, and he's a big deal. So
yeah.
I guess we're our kind of, you know, spanning the, at least the states are part of them. But this year, you know, we're keeping it a little smaller, maybe 65 authors maximum. Most will be from Westchester and Putnam. We'll have some new ones from the city. But it's a constant analysis of, you know, grade level, fiction versus nonfiction, really topical things like racism or LGBTQ issues. We really try to keep a very panoramic view on what's happening in the children's book world. And, you know, I will admit that sometimes a parent will put a bug in my ear and say, my kid really loves XYZ. Can you reach out to her? And I will, and 9 times out of 10 they'll come, which is wonderful. So that's the fun part, looking for new authors. Yeah, if I had my druthers, we'd have 400 authors spread over a week. one year.
Wow.
But last year was 150 authors, and that was fun and intense and just a crazy day, a good crazy day.
It had to be. So where do you find the drive to keep going?
Oh, my gosh. Not to get terribly political, but I feel like this country is in such a need of empathy. And to me, maybe the subtitle of this festival could be Helping Our Kids Empathize, because I feel like I know that reading is key. One of my sons is a fabulous student only because he's been an avid reader from day one. And I think students who read like that are set up for success. So, you know, first of all, I'd like to spread that among as many kids as possible. But similarly, I want kids to be able to escape and to empathize and to, you know, see parts of the world they don't see in Westchester County. And I think a lot of our authors really are great at that kind of transporting you to another place. And I think that's the key to empathy, to live in, to, you know, for a book, for the length of a book, to live in India or to live, you know, back in the days of George Washington or whatever. Lauren Tarshish has a series called I Survive, and she comes and she's hugely popular because kids like that thrill of I survived Hurricane Katrina or I survived World War II. So that, you know, there's a lot of good ingredients that go into all of this, picking the books, picking the style, and picking just someone who kind of has that feeling, intuitively or otherwise, for what kids need or want at a given time.
And do kids want to know everything? Is there no subject that they're afraid to tackle, whereas their parents might? Have we opened up a new page in what we're willing and capable of understanding, or at least tolerating, becoming aware? You know, because there are a lot of new subjects that are coming up seemingly out of the woodwork that a lot of people were not comfortable with. The LGBTQ community certainly comes to mind, but the color line between different peoples, ethnicities, and so on. We're tackling a big, big issues that we've never tackled before.
Right, and I think it's our obligation to do that to the degree, you know, parents will accept. Like, for example, Kyle Lukoff is a fairly new author to us. He's a transgender male. He was a school librarian, and he wrote a great storybook, When Aiden Becomes a Brother. Won a Stonewall Award. Big deal. I was really happy that we called him just as his career was taking off. But in fact, in Utah and Texas, they've kicked up a fuss about his book being used in the classroom. You know, another reason I'm so grateful to live in New York and Westchester is I can't imagine parents here having that reaction. So,
exactly.
we I'm I'm not afraid to go where we need to go. We have a new writer, Brendan Kiley, who's written How to Have the Talk. And the talk, this talk in this instance is to your white kids about how to understand racism and how to make yourself an anti-racism ally. So again, topical, sometimes touchy subject, but you know, these people are so brilliant, these writers, and the way they tackle these things, that we have an obligation to get them out there, I think.
Absolutely. It's awesome, the capacity of language, and especially when it's presented in a sincere way. Well, getting back to Biscuit's author, evidently there's a musical coming. I can't stand it. This is very, very exciting. How did you come up with a musical?
This was something that a theatrical company took under their wing, and they adapted some of the books, and they did a really, really wonderful job. I've actually sat in the audience and, you know, watched children watch the show, and, you know, see how they kind of root and cheer and know the story so well and hope things will work out the way that they know it should, with great, very uplifting and positive musical numbers. So it's really just been a lot of fun to see the way this has all evolved.
It's exciting for you.
It's very exciting. I think I said earlier, it's, you know, I very often pinch myself because it's just really wonderful, and it is for every author and every illustrator. You know, as Dawn mentioned, no matter what we're writing about, the impact on a reader and the way that literature connects us, you know, from the very youngest to our teens, to our tweens, to our adults. And that's what's so wonderful about the festival, is when you can meet people who understand the way you feel or perhaps share an experience. It's really just a truly direct and great connection. So, I'm very, very fortunate that the musical, well, of course, it was suspended because of the pandemic, but we're hoping it comes back soon.
Absolutely. And do you also get, like, fan mail from your readers? That must be very exciting, I would think.
I do. And it's not only exciting, but it's very touching and endearing.
Yeah.
What is most surprising to me is that I get letters not only from children who we might expect to get letters from, but from children of all ages, teens who remember the series from when they were younger, and sometimes even adults who are learning to read, and that is fascinating. And so sometimes I'll get tips on what readers would like to hear about. Most often it's the connection. My readers might be puppy lovers too, or they may live in the country and they loved reading about Biscuit in the big city because they've never been exposed to that. So on this really simple scale in a small book, you know, it's lovely to hear that people have been touched and exposed, and that they're experiencing things that they're not quite used to or not exposed to through the eyes of this little puppy.
They're really fascinating, which brings to mind, you know, a question I have for Ms. Greenberg. How do you find people who have a sense of sensibility and capacity to reach out through their books to the population that you serve? Because you must read all of these books. I don't know how you do it. Do you call up?
She's amazing.
I can't even imagine.
Well, first of all,
I don't think you have time to boil water. considering all you do.
Oh, you're funny. You know, I was always an avid reader. I maybe mentioned this last time we spoke. I had read all of the Nancy Drew books by the time I was in second grade. So I can just plow through no matter what else is going on in my chaotic household. And it's just so, it's really, but, you know, you can, there's, you've got two sides of your brain you could work at any given point. And I just, I allow myself to kind of go along for the ride. Like right now I'm rereading My Side of the Mountain because we're going to be honoring Jean Craighead George this year. I don't know if you remember reading that when you were little. But you really, you know, it's a 12-year-old boy who runs away to the Catskills. And you really feel like you're on that side of the mountain with him, you know, trying to find dinner, trying to start a fire. And, you know, what that to me is a beautiful thing because there's so much chaos swirling around us always. And to be able to just go find a chair and escape to the Catskills, you know, it's a beautiful thing. So, and I honestly, as far as finding authors that have the right sensibility, I think kids, and especially kids, probably parents as well, kids can very much detect sincerity versus someone who's just like putting words on a page, I'm sure. You know, books rise to the top for a reason. You know, these authors are extremely talented. It probably looks like, you know, modern art sometimes. It seems like they must just throw paint on a page or words on a page, but in fact they construct, they think about, they walk away, their editor weighs in, you know, even a, you know, a baby, a board book even I expect has a lot of process to it. So, absolutely. You know, it's quite a skill to be a kid's book writer or illustrator.
I would think so, and a great responsibility too. How do you put on the Chappaqua Children's Book Festival? What do you do for that? Is it like a particular venue? Is that where you're going to be operating from?
Mm-hmm. We're always outside. We typically have been at the Bell Middle School in downtown, though this year we're moving to the train station just because we think we can spread out more there. And we have a lot of people who do come up on the train, so that'll make their life easier. But, you know, we have hundreds of volunteers on the day. This year the volunteer situation will be even more interesting because we're going to give each author a volunteer to help them kind of police their line. For instance, Alyssa's line is long all day long, and we want to, you know, keep a good social distance. So that's going to probably be our big challenge this year, is keeping the excited kids in a line. And, you know, we of course, promised our authors we're going to do our utmost to keep them safe. I feel a big responsibility about that this year. But we also want everybody to have a lot of fun, and I think we will. I am not doubting that in the slightest.
So you must have a very large mailing list of people that have come from before. So we do like a major email blast to get people to know when the event is. And when is your upcoming event?
Saturday, October 2nd. Typically, we do a big campaign on the Metro North line, but this year people aren't taking Metro North so much, so I hope we'll do, you know, more editorial placements. Westchester Magazine writes about us, Westchester Family, all the kids' magazines feature us, you know, and everybody immediately and around Chappaqua, Pleasantville, Briarcliff, et cetera, they always come. We get the word out to teachers. We get the word out through Westchester Library System.
That's great.
If I dare say so, we've become an event that people know to watch for. They know to put it on their calendar. So,
absolutely.
Yep.
You should be very proud. Do you get calls from other people who want to emulate what you do in Chappaqua in other communities across the country? Because I'm sure you're recognized all over the world.
Well, I don't know about the world, but funny you say that. Bath, Maine is starting a festival, I believe, in September. And we've had some calls from them, how do you do it? But more excitingly, a group in Rye is putting on a festival, I guess, the Saturday after us, so the 9th.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sure you'll be hearing about that. I hope, of course, people come to both festivals. But, yeah, I was happy for them. They're using the same books that we do. That's a big piece of the puzzle, getting all the books, the right books, the quantity of the books in place for this. So, yeah, we're thrilled. Anybody who calls me, I'm happy to tell them how we've done it. You know, our big consideration is always, are the kids happy and safe, and are the authors happy? And I think we accomplished that. I do.
So what caused Bath to reach out to you in Maine? I've been to Bath. I just loved it. It's a beautiful. There's a state of mind about Maine which captivated me from the moment I got there. So so how did they find you?
We're, you know, these days everyone sees everything on social media, so I think they probably found us on Twitter or Facebook. And I love Maine, too. We're going in a couple of weeks, and one day I'm just going to set up another book festival in Maine, I'm convinced, because I really think many communities could benefit by doing this. They don't have to do it on the large scale that we do, but, you know, authors, I think, love meeting their fans because often authors work kind of, you know, in solitude, and there are authors all over the country, interesting, wonderful authors all over the country. So, yeah, if I had my way, every town would have a book festival, I guess.
I think you're right.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, as valuable as it is for the readers to connect with their favorite authors and illustrators, it's equally important and wonderful for us to meet and connect with our readers. So I was just, you know, seconding what Dawn said.
Absolutely. I was going to ask you, so you're going to go on Broadway. Have you any idea when you're going to be opening up?
It's more of a regional show, not quite Broadway yet, I'll say, because you never know. But it has toured all over the United States for 2 years prior to the pandemic. We unfortunately, you know, shut down rather quickly, as did the entire country. But it's gone to some beautiful and wonderful theaters, and it's been a great family event, and school groups have gone to see it, and I hope we can return sooner than later.
Sounds very exciting. That would really be wonderful. Even if you're off Broadway, it's really terrific, and there's so many beautiful venues. Hey, you can do it in Chappaqua too, right?
I would love to, yes.
1,000%, yes.
Very, very good. Any last words from either one of you? Because we've only got about 2 minutes left before we have to shut down, or they shut us down at 12.
Well, what I always say, read with your children, read yourself, model reading. Kids need to see adults reading in the house, not just on their telephones. And, you know, take some time in August to find a shady spot, sit with your kids, and, you know, just dive in, basically. Libraries are a great thing. The libraries are all coming back online, and I think, you know, they've got books that people didn't get to see last year. So there's a lot of great things out there.
Well, it's been a pleasure to speak to both of you, to get reacquainted with Dawn Greenberg. What a pleasure for me. And to meet Alyssa Satin Capsilli. Wonderful, just wonderful. It couldn't have gotten better. What a great way to end the today's broadcast. I hope we'll talk again, anytime you have something to talk about, you know, you could always give me a call. You know, I'm not averse to that at all. So a pleasure to hear from both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Hope
to see you at the festival.
Yes, please come, Hezzy. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Be well.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Well, there we are, folks. That's the end of our broadcast day. We'll speak to you tomorrow. And until then, just have a great day. And I guess that's about it. So we're going to shut down the store here and say goodbye. Have a good day. Bye.